I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University. We're online at radioopensource.org. Jonah Lehrer is a wondrously curious, confident amateur working the fortified borderland between art and science. His first book, at age 26, is called Proust Was a Neuroscientist. He means not just that the great novelist of Paris a century ago, who unlocked his own memories of childhood with a cookie dipped in lime flower tea, should get credit for cracking the mysterious connection between the senses and the mind. More generally, he's saying that the giants of 19th and 20th century arts, Walt Whitman, the poet of The Body Electric, the novelist George Eliot, Cézanne, the post-impressionist painter, Gertrude Stein, the revolutionary prose stylist, and others, he's saying they got to the essentials of brain science by intuition and study before the frontal cortex and the neural pathways in our heads were ever mapped. Lehrer's argument is not anti-science exactly, though scientists could hear in it a call for humility and some broadening of their scope. We spoke at the back of a bookshop in Cambridge. Jonah Lehrer, will the next book be Watson and Crick Were Poets? Could you turn this whole argument around that scientists are artists too?
Well, the book, I think, is really about a dialogue, about trying to foment and create a dialogue between art and science. So I don't think that the knowledge only moves in one direction, and it's only artists who are capable of predicting science. Some of my favorite artists do root their work in scientific fact, like Ian McEwan and like Richard Powers. There's lots of modern artists who are studying the visual cortex and fascinated by it. So I don't think it's necessarily a one-way street, or certainly hope it's not a one-way street. The point of this book was simply to try to imagine a dialogue, what a dialogue would look like if artists and scientists shared a common language.
What I love about the book is that you're so confident at a very tough intersection, and you've done an awful lot of reading in the Virginia Woolf, Proust, modern mode, and you know your science too. I mean, you've worked in a lab with Eric Kandel. This is a place where we all want to get. Maybe what I really want to ask you is how do we get there?
I think we could all begin by reading Virginia Woolf or Proust. I think one of the first steps is to take art seriously, to not just see art as a collection of pretty things or entertaining things or occasionally, if you're lucky, something beautiful. But to take art seriously, to look at art and try to understand art in terms of what it can teach us about the mind, to look at art in terms of truth, in these grand terms, to interrogate the art and say, well, what can this painting or poem or novel teach me about my brain? So I think that's the first step. And I think that's an important first step to kind of look at this art through a new kind of critical lens. And I also think artists should engage with the science. I think it's important for artists to read Nature and Cell and Neuron and these scientific journals. And, neuroscience, modern neuroscience is full of wonderful, weird discoveries about how these 3 pounds of gelatinous flesh inside our skull actually work. And I think these bizarre facts, and they're often very bizarre, can't help but inspire science, can't help but inspire art. These are two very different descriptions of the human mind, of human nature, and I hope that they can't help but inspire each other.
You're showing us how people can be bifocal or bilingual, and yet I sense a tremendous resistance on both parts. The artists tend to see the sciences as reductionist, explaining away the mystery, and scientists, I think, still want to see poets as bubbleheads.
Yes, and I think that certainly is a big problem. I think part of the problem too is that as an undergraduate, you're parceled into one of these categories. You're either a scientist or you're an artist, in which case you're taking physics for poets, and that's your science requirement very early on. So I think it's important not to just let the different vocabularies these two cultures use to talk about the mind interfere with the dialogue. But I do hope that once scientists see that Proust was very serious about the mind, about studying the mind, that Virginia Woolf, as she wrote, really wanted to get the facts of psychology accurately. She wrote that in her diary before she began writing Miss Dalloway, that Paul Cézanne would spend years painting the same mountain because he really wanted to understand the mountain, to understand how his eye saw the mountain, how his brain interpreted the light entering his eye, that there was a real rigor to their method. I hope that shows scientists that they aren't just bubbleheads, that these artists aren't just throwing their whims and prejudices onto the page or the canvas. And I also hope the reverse is true, that artists can see that scientists can take their art seriously and don't just see it as a symptom to be explained away using evolutionary psychology or, you know, the latest study of the visual cortex, that it's a serious phenomenon, and that by studying great art, you can figure out how the mind works. You can reverse engineer the art, in essence, to learn about the mind. And that's not to you know, explain away the art, as you put it, but simply to reveal a new level of depth within the art, a new layer upon which that allows Proust to work so well.
This conflict came up in a conversation the other night with Oliver Sacks, a man I revere, and I know you do too. And yet, of course, he's a medical doctor, very imaginative student of the mind, and yet he's very, very squeamish about entering the realm where his patients end up, where we all end up in some fashion, in a realm of mystery, of spirit, of eternal, unanswerable questions. And he said to me in a public conversation, I can't go there. I'm forever rooted in the clinical. And I thought, bless that man, he's such an example, but is there a failure of imagination there to go even where his patient, who'd been struck by lightning and discovered this profound appetite for music and for God, want to go?
I sympathize with Oliver Sacks' dilemma. I think to take the facts of science seriously is to know that there is no metaphysical soul hidden inside the skull, that we are just 3 pounds of electrical flesh. That's just what we are. On the other hand, I think it's naive to believe that describing the mind in those third-person terms can ever explain the first-person experience of reality, of this. So I think it's very tricky. You have to be, I've certainly been very aware of all the possible pitfalls in trying to, on the one hand, admit that there is no metaphysical soul. The soul doesn't exist. The soul is just an emergent property. And yet, on the other hand...
Let's stop. Dispose of that question.
No, yes, but if you take the facts of science seriously, then we are just material. We are just synaptic proteins and kinase enzymes and all those other bizarre ingredients that go into our.
But I want you to leave room for the mystery, even as Oliver Sacks does. As your wonderful line in the book is that science, though it has taken the ghost out of the machine in many respects, leaves us all in a place where we still experience life as the ghost, not the machine.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the reality of human experience. And I also think there's an irony embedded in the science, which is that the more we know about the brain, in a sense, the more mysterious that property becomes. The better we understand the machine, the harder it is to really comprehend how a ghost emerges out of the machine, how even though we are just this, you know, a brain, we feel like subjective beings with a self, and we're self-aware and all these very mysterious properties. I absolutely believe that there's an essential mystery that will always remain. No matter how much we know about how the brain works, we're never going to be able to explain experience, self-consciousness, in those third-person material terms. And it's that mystery, the mystery of how the water of the brain becomes the wine of the mind, that I think is the subject of art.
Oliver Sacks made the interesting observation the other night that William James never uses the word soul in his Principles of Psychology, but he used it endlessly in conversation and, of course, in the varieties of religious experience.
I mean, certainly William James was also trying to thread this fine line. If you look at the Principles of Psychology, which is still the great psychological textbook from the, you know, it's of the 19th century, but it feels incredibly modern for the most part. The first 8 chapters, and that's the part which has aged, that describes the mind in the terms of psychophysics. It's the standard scientific method, measurement, quantification. That's what the brain is. the kind of strict terms of science. Chapter 9 begins with the famous line, "We now begin the study of the mind from within." And I feel like it's that aspect of the mind, that looking at the mind through our own eyes, trying to understand experience, not by breaking it apart, but just by analyzing experience itself, that I think science has lost, and we do have to recover the pursuit of William James in that sense.
Has anybody trumped William James's position here, really, as a kind of a scientist still in awe of human mystery?
I don't think so. I mean, William James is one of my true intellectual heroes. So I certainly don't think so. I think William James managed to continually thread that fine line between trying to explain something, whether it's religious phenomena or just the mystery of experience, without automatically trying to explain it away. On the one hand, taking it seriously, and yet treating it as a scientific subject. No one has done it better since. And that's why he remains one of my intellectual heroes. And I talk in the end of the book about, if you're trying to come up with a new model of truth, if science isn't our only avenue of understanding truths about the mind, and if artists can also intuit important truths about the mind, then what does this mean about truth? And I think there William James also can give us an example. And that's where pragmatism comes in, that the test of something, whether or not something is true, is whether it's useful. So in that sense, a poem which answers a long-standing mystery about, for example, Walt Whitman and his understanding of how the body and mind interact, Walt Whitman can be just as true as a 21st century neuroscience experiment. The test of truth is whether or not it works. In that sense, art can work just as well as science.
Where did the word reductionism enter the language, and how do we feel it? How does science feel about it now? The glory of being able to explain something and the burden of feeling that you've devalued it, you've made it just a reaction.
Unravel the rainbow. Certainly that tension has been there since the early 19th century. I believe that's Blake's line, unravel the rainbow. And so certainly, even if they didn't call it reductionism back then, certainly that's the scientific method. You take complex phenomena and break them apart, study their simplest possible parts. And so when that comes to the mind, that means all we are is just these lists of ingredients, this electricity in the frontal cortex. We're a list of material parts. And that's been the pursuit, that's been the process, the method of neuroscience for at least the last 50 years. And really, I think it's become the only method of neuroscience. That's how it understands the mind. And certainly, that's had phenomenal success. We've learned so much about the way the brain works, from the smallest details in synapses, the spaces between neurons, to understanding how these networks of neurons come together to represent a memory. So we've learned a tremendous amount about the mind, and yet I also think it's important to kind of step back and realize that no matter how much we know about the brain, that as we said before, this essential mystery will remain.
John O'Lara, I take your book to be not anti-science, and yet you keep the thrust of the argument is that artists get there first, that they describe states of mind even in the ways that we remember, the ways that resonate with our own experience, and that there is a kind of caution here to this wonderful machine of science that they've got to learn humility too. Do I take it right?
Yes, for the most part. Certainly the scientific method will always be our primary method of understanding reality. It's incredibly effective at what it does. And yet I think it's naive to think that the scientific method is the only method. That's the only way we can understand human nature and the way the mind works. And what I simply try to argue in the book is that art represents a essential other way of understanding the mind, an essential way of looking at the brain from the inside. And so I think we need both pursuits. If we are going to try to grapple with these big mysteries, the mystery of consciousness, the mystery of what the self is, then we need science and art to work together.
Is there an American problem here and a problem of this moment? And I'm also wondering if there's something analogous to the anxiety around evolutionary science on one hand and the abiding human hunger for design and even a designer?
In terms of the tension with reductionism, why we're sensitive to it? I mean, there's certainly something deeply unromantic about the idea that there might not be a soul, that self-consciousness is, to use the term of scientists, an epiphenomenon, almost an illusion, that it's just a property of brain cells, and the reality is brain cells, what you're saying, you know, what you experience is an illusion. I think science is in an awkward position there, because in essence what it's doing is it's forced to deny, because of reductionism, the one reality we know, the only reality we'll ever know, which is the reality of experience, of self-conscious experience. In terms of how that plays into larger cultural trends, involving, I think, anti-science and intelligent design and all those questions, that's probably a bit beyond my pay grade. I do think people are sensitive to these questions, to, I think, what they feel as science is not just unraveling the rainbow, but it's unraveling their own existence and somehow devaluing it. I certainly don't feel that. I'm thrilled to learn how my visual cortex works. I'd be excited if one day science did manage to discover the roots of consciousness, because I don't believe that somehow discovering the roots of consciousness, the cellular roots, undermines my experience of consciousness. I think there's still a mystery that will remain, that science can't solve. But I think it's important to talk about this, and to get out in the open.
What would be the word to describe the opposite of reductionism? The complexity, the multivalent understandings that the great ones, including George Eliot and Virginia Woolf and Proust and Walt Whitman, all embody. A relaxed confidence with many, many perspectives on the truth or reality.
Yeah, I mean, I'd argue that the opposite of reductionism is art. Art is holistic. It's about synthesis. It's about not trying to take experience apart. Virginia Woolf didn't want to take self-consciousness and do experimental assays and use control variables. She didn't want to measure anything. She wanted to study it. Just look at it, take it as it is. Study the thing itself. I think it's a very different attitude from neuroscience, which is always trying to break things into their constituent elements. So they really are, I think, two very divergent processes. And yet, I think what's so interesting is that you can see that even though these methods seem so different, even though they use such different languages, such different vocabularies, you can find these moments where they're describing the same thing.
You know, Marjorie Garber is an eminent Shakespearean here at Harvard, but a modernist and a very, very broad mind. She made the observation, turning a Walter Pater line around. Walter Pater said that all art aspires to the condition of music. And Marjorie Garber said, in the current university world, all disciplines aspire, even her own in the humanities, aspire to the condition of cognitive science. Do you know what she meant? Can you unpack that a little bit?
I do. I'd even go broader. I'd say in current academia, all disciplines aspire to the condition of science, period. I think the seriousness with which we take the latest science paper, that's truth with a capital T. That's it. Those are the facts of reality. I think who doesn't want to describe truth? Who doesn't want to capture reality as it is? I think that's particularly true of cognitive science. Here you have a science which because it describes the facts of the mind, I think has a very eminent place. This is cognitive science, cognitive psychology, and neuroscience in terms of describing the world. I mean, we see the world through the prism of our brain. So if you can figure out how the brain works, then I think you're very eminent, in the academic totem pole.
But you'd also argue, surely, that you can't get there without art, too.
Oh, I don't mean to endorse all disciplines aspiring to the conditions of cognitive science. I certainly disagree with that idea. I believe there are many different kinds of truth, and that Proust can also be true, that Virginia Woolf can also be true. And I, I, I don't believe that all disciplines should aspire to conditions of science. I believe disciplines, you know, it's good that we have different ways of describing the mind. I would shudder to think if we only had, if the only way we could learn about the way the mind works is through neuroscience. I think that'd be an impoverished view of the mind. It would neglect all sorts of mysteries and questions, which we should really be grappling with. You know, and I think, as I argue in the book, that you'd also miss out on important discoveries, that you'd know less about memory if you never read Proust. So all disciplines absolutely should not aspire to the condition of cognitive science. The cognitive sciences are an incredibly important way of understanding the mind, but they're not the only one.
Joan Alero, what's the short course for young people, middle-aged people, older people who would love to take up your confident, curious position between these realms of art and science?
I'd say go and read an introductory neuroscience textbook, learn a bit about how your brain cells work, and then go read Proust and go read literature. And then once I think you have the idea, you know, once you are able to see the world, interpret the world through this prism of science. You know, for me, it was realizing that Proust actually anticipated the experiments in memory I was doing in a neuroscience lab. Once you've got that viewpoint, you can't help but look at a Cezanne painting and think about the visual cortex. You can't help but eat a veal stock, a sauce made of veal stock, and think about the way the tongue works. So for me, at least, it was a profoundly enriched way of looking at the world.
Didn't hurt the flavor.
No, not at all. It still tastes good. Cezanne's still beautiful.
Joan Alero, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Check us out. Leave a comment. Suggest a show at www.radioopensource.org.